Welcome to the February edition of the Urology Journal Club podcast. We're going to look at five papers today. The first comes as research highlights from the British Journal, and this considers a paper that was published as the 23-year follow-up of the European study of prostate cancer screening. This dates all the way back to 1993, with the question being whether PSA testing could lower prostate cancer mortality. They had a huge 162,000 men from different European countries, and at 23 years, it showed a 13% relative reduction of prostate cancer. And for every one prostate cancer death averted, they would need to screen 456 men, and 12 men would need to be diagnosed with prostate cancer. This paper is clearly ongoing work that is suggesting a role for screening, but despite that, screening has not been adopted in national programs in Europe, and they refer to the fact that there's mainly opportunistic screening that is in fact taking place, and there appears to be an excess of screening in men older than 70, and perhaps a paucity of screening in the men in their 50s in terms of how it might impact prostate cancer deaths. They also refer to the fact that we now have slightly better tools in terms of using MRI testing and potentially molecular biomarkers, which may improve our understanding of who in fact needs to be screened. The next paper briefly considered here is something that we've known that's going to be coming related to artificial intelligence, and it relates to a study which looked at Gleason, and artificial intelligence appears to be having a role, particularly in pathology and radiology. and these models were able to be comparable or superior performance in terms of assessing Gleason pattern compared with experienced uropathologists. So that's quite. The next paper comes from the World Journal, and it's an editorial co-authored with Thomas Herrmann from Switzerland, one of the senior editors of the journal. And it talks about rethinking LUTs or BPH management, and they're making a case for multidisciplinary team approach. And I suppose this isn't something that's ever something that I've thought about. One assumes that most patients can be managed simply by the caring urological surgeon. They make the point that BPO has significant effect on the patient's quality of life, and the prevalence appears to be rising. Many men can be managed simply with lifestyle changes, with or without medication, but a significant proportion do in fact desire a surgical option for their BPO, or if it progresses. And I think one of the triggers for this is the rise of numerous minimally invasive surgical options, so-called MISTs, such as UroLift, Resume, iTint, aquablation, prostate artery embolization, amongst others. And those newer options are going to take their place with alongside TURP and HOLIP. So the traditional model is probably outdated, and they in fact propose that focusing on these multidisciplinary clinics on more complex cases, those who've got larger prostates, for example, or where there may in fact be mixed storage and voiding symptoms, and certainly also those who are comorbid or those who are frail, elderly. So the potential benefits are that healthcare is certainly under strain, and there are competing interests from multiple departments within the institution, and the importance of efficacy in the patient journey cannot be overstated, and clearly making a call for quality of care here in terms of feeling that a multidisciplinary team can offer more. They asked the question, well, who should be the members of such team, and they should there be at least two urological surgeons and a special interest in BPO management, then an administrative person and a specialist nurse. So those are the kind of people who could help run such a clinic. And I think this is a very good proposal and a novel one, and I think we should think more clearly and carefully about our strategy in managing these patients rather than simply the way that we've done these things in the past. Then for the next paper, we moved to a review from the British Journal about cannabis use and the risk of testicular germ cell tumour. This is a systematic review and meta-analysis. I've certainly noticed in our clinics that many of the men that we treat do appear to have a cannabis background, but I've never read about this before. But interestingly, these authors managed to track down 86 articles were identified, and they were able to show that current cannabis use was significantly associated with the increase of testicular tumour. And even those men who'd simply used it on a very odd occasion, they also had greater incidence compared with men who had never used it. And these findings highlighted that cannabis use is a significant modifiable risk factor in the development of testicular cancer. Begs the question, why or how could cannabis be involved here? And before I get to that, perhaps just to mention that the trends in cannabis use seem to be going up from the United States. They quote a doubling of 7% usage in 2013 up to as much as 15% in 2022. The authors blame this on lax regulations or legalizing cannabis use, and that's clearly involved. So what about the mechanisms that might link cannabis to testicular germ cell tumor? They say it's not precisely understood, but there is evidence that cannabis impairs testicular production and may be genotoxic, and that might have then a carcinogenic role. So I think this is a new thing that I wasn't aware of in the pathogenesis of germ cell tumor, and I think worth trying to popularize amongst our colleagues the dangers of cannabis use related to testicular tumor. The next paper comes from authors from Belém in Brazil. It includes Sampaio, who's famous for the anatomy of the kidney. And this paper looks specifically at thiazide diuretics in kidney stone recurrence. We know that guidelines would recommend in high-risk patients who have recurrent calcium-containing stones that consideration be given to the use of thiazides. And this is a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials looking to see the efficacy of that treatment. They found 9 trials, which included roughly 1,000 patients. And of note, the current evidence, they conclude, does not support the use of thiazides in preventing kidney stone recurrence due to severe limitations with the trials and due to the potential side effects of the use of thiazides. So we know much of the important aspects about kidney stones being that various risk factors, including the metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, are risk factors for development of stones. We know that anything that prevents these stones can be helpful in high-risk patients. They note that recurrence rates up to 50% from 5 to 10 years, and they quote a figure of 75% within 20 years of the first episode. So clearly a recurrent disease. We also know the financial impact that roughly $9 billion is spent in the United States alone to manage kidney stones annually. And in addition, the indirect costs go up to around $1.5 billion if you include missed days at work for these patients. Now, the European guidelines recommend fluid intake, nutritional advice, and lifestyle advice as general risk factors, but you also need to stratify patients into high and low risk, and the high-risk patients may benefit from some prophylaxis to reduce kidney stone formation. The thiazide diuretics are known to work on the sodium-calcium co-transport in the kidney, and this is then said to reduce, to improve calcium reabsorption in the distal tubule, which then allows for less calcium to be excreted in the urine. However, thiazide diuretics also attended with severe side effects such as electrolyte disturbances, hypokalemia, for example. There's apparently an increased risk of skin cancer, and also it promotes diabetes. So these drugs are not without their problems. And the current guidelines, thiazides are considered a standard prophylaxis. However, it's worth noting an important trial called the No Stone Trial, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which effectively randomized people to either thiazides or no thiazides at various doses of thiazide, and were unable to show any difference in outcome in terms of kidney stone recurrence between the various groups when compared with placebo. So the authors therefore conclude that the benefits of thiazides need to be revisited and perhaps removed from the guidelines, since they conclude that they should not be routinely prescribed. So I think a practice changing article and a reconsideration of what we do with our high-risk patients. Lastly, we're going to consider a paper that comes from my colleagues at the University of Witwatersrand. The notable lead author here is Ahmed Adams, and he, with his colleagues, looked at whether prior video game exposure and ureteroscopic skills, whether this was correlation or coincidence. And they investigated 160 undergraduate students, and they defined them as gamers and non-gamers and looked at their demographics. And in the past, video game exposure has been thought to enhance visuomotor and cognitive skills relevant for urological procedures and ureteroscopic performance between gamers and non-gaming students. Was the aim of their study to investigate that. They defined gamers as anyone who played more than 3 hours a week, and whether they would outperform those who were non-gamers. The results did in fact show that there was a significant difference in urological skills, and these were assessed by ureteroscopic models. And they also showed that male participants outperformed female participants, irrespective of their gaming status. So I think they're pointing to the important fact that physiomotor skills, whether you acquire them with gaming or through other task-driven exercises, such as laparoscopic trainers or other trainers, clearly do have a role in improving the kind of skills needed for endourology. So colleagues, thank you for your attention and look forward to meeting again in March.